The other day I was considering starting with a new client, and I thought to myself, where do I start? And then the answer came to me, I should start at the beginning. So this talk today is about, let's start at the beginning. Here's a point. The consciousness of our parents are injected into the sperm and the ovum that are fertilized and then become us. These ingredients, the consciousnesses of our parents, make a difference. Think of it like this. We're all trying to reach the proverbial top of the mountain. You've used that expression, I bet. You've heard it used before as well. We could say that the real top of the mountain is oneness with divine consciousness. But everybody gets a chance to make up what they believe to be the tops of the mountains in various areas of their lives based upon what they believe to be desirable or detestable. The consciousnesses of our parents and, frankly, the consciousness that we bring into this lifetime based upon our previous incarnations determine exactly where on the mountain we're going to be starting from in this lifetime, what resources we're starting with, and which resources we will have to acquire in the course of our lives once we begin it. Imagine that this mountain has numerous slopes and numerous plateaus. In other words, going from the bottom to the top is not like taking an elevator or an escalator. In fact, it's a kind of a jagged-looking design if we were to draw this on a piece of paper. So we might start, and everybody has an opportunity to decide for themselves in this lifetime, whether we started on an easy slope or a difficult slope, or if we started on a lower level plateau, a mid-level plateau, or a higher level plateau. And those starting points are going to be based upon the three consciousnesses that were our ingredients, our father's consciousness, our mother's consciousness, and our own that we bring to this lifetime. So, what do we do about this? In every case, whenever we're traveling, not just climbing a mountain of consciousness, or any other mountain for that matter, is to become aware of where we are. Where we want to go, we have an opportunity to decide that. That's the definition of the top of the mountain that I was referring to a moment ago. What accumulated items we need to discard or jettison or let go of. What we need to acquire to continue our climb in an enjoyable, exciting, thrilling, growthful fashion up the mountain of consciousness. I would guess that if you're listening to this recording, then you and I are at some level or some slope or plateau that is above the lower levels. I think that the lower level thinking and feeling and behaving probably do not include considerations of trying to elevate one's consciousness. I think basically to think in these terms, you've got to be pretty well on your way to start with. In reality, I say it doesn't really matter where we start from, only what top we can perceive. That top will draw us to it magnetically, just as it will enable us to draw the resources to us that are necessary for us to keep climbing. As I said, it doesn't really matter where we start from during this lifetime in the climb. By that, I mean no one starting point is better than another. They're just starting points. If we had a difficult conception, gestation in utero, a difficult birth and or traumatic experiences in our early life, I think we're faced with two basic choices. Choose one or the other. One, we can interpret those conception in utero experiences, the birth, the traumas, as the cause for our problems, the cause of our ill health, the cause for our lack of success, the cause for whatever, and let it go at that. We can become a victim to those experiences and believe that they determine everything in our lives. I think there's a better choice, and I call this the item number two, is that we can interpret these experiences from conception in utero, at birth, and those traumatic or even tragic experiences early in our lives as strength-building experiences that are necessary for the health that is coming our way, for the peace that we're attracting, for the success that will be ours, and on and on. We can see them as being beneficial to our overall climb. I use a model of judging experiences that says we give the meaning to those experiences. And the meaning that we assign to those experiences determines the very nature and effect of those experiences. We can look at where we are right now. Let's say we're at a kind of a balanced or a normal place. We'll call it ordinary and acceptable to us. And maybe we'll just define that as balanced. We're in the middle of life, and we're in a balanced position at this moment. When we're under pressure and we're being challenged or stressed, we can consider that condition as being compressed. And the way I would demonstrate this is to say, I've got a balloon filled with air in my hands, and I'm squeezing it. I'm compressing it. There's no loss of air. It's just being pressured from the outside. And so it's being compressed. I actually believe that compression is kind of like a demand. Demands have that same impact on us, that they're necessary for us to gather our thoughts, gather our energy, and to call forth additional resources in order to meet the challenge that happens to be compressing us at that moment. Compression is the same principle that we would use when we go to the gym. Let's say we're going to go to the gym to work out and to become stronger. We compress our muscles, which results in those muscles calling forth whatever energy forms, hormones, and you know all kinds of physical things that are real complicated, in order to become stronger and to meet the challenges that are currently compressing them. Whatever weights we happen to be using, say it's 20 pounds or 30 pounds or 100 pounds or whatever. And now all of a sudden we are dealing with those things and growing. We could also disadvantage ourselves through our interpretation of events by thinking we are not compressed, but diminished. This is when we believe we have lost life force and have become less than we were. I'll go back to the balloon I have in my hands. I'm squeezing this balloon. I'm compressing it. But if I believe that I'm losing life force, as if some pin was stuck in the balloon, so air is leaving it, and now it is literally becoming less and less, that would be diminution. The ultimate result of diminution on a physical level, right, diminish, 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 is death. Now, my belief that the most harmful is suicide, when we try to diminish ourselves into non-existence as if that is a workable solution to being challenged. Of course, it is not. What we want to do is reinterpret any experiences we still think diminished us, made us less, caused us to lose life force. The result of that reinterpretation will be to see events as compression, not diminution. And because we can understand now logically that compression results in strengthening, and that condition, that strengthened condition, I'm going to call expansion. We can accept this as a natural condition of growth, just like a muscle would grow if we compress it in the gym. Compress it, relax it, compress it, relax it, compress it, relax it. We would know that that exercise is going to result in expansion of that muscle. If you think of it, expansion is characterized by bigger, stronger, more solid, and it has observable physical characteristics. Further up the line to a condition that we really would seek to go to from expansion is what I call enhancement. This is better, higher, more aware, more connected. If I'm talking about the difference between expansion and enhancement, I'm saying that enhancement is a qualitative condition. It's about quality more than it is about quantity, more than it is about size, which expansion is. Enhancement is more about a realization of spirituality than the other states. If I were to look at the other states from diminution to compression to balanced to expanded to enhanced, enhanced is more about the spiritual connection and knowingness of what it is we really are. Unlike a climb in the mountain in the Himalayas, say Mount Everest, in life, we have an unlimited amount of time in which to succeed. We're not restricted to days, weeks, months, years, or even lifetimes, because we do have lifetimes to make the climb and to reach the top. In this lifetime, making progress is the goal. And the more we enjoy it, the more heightened our awareness is, the more progress we're making. It's not that we have to finish in this lifetime. It's not about how fast we can live. And I like Gandhi's quote that says something to the effect that there's more to life than making it go fast. It's about the grace, about the love, about the enjoyment, the joy, generosity, and higher values that we can relate to. And I would say as we climb in the life, the question becomes, what do we discard? What do we get rid of? And what resources do we need to acquire? What do we need to obtain? And where do they come from? You know from your life now that you've acquired materials and clothing and books and other things over the course of your lifetime, and ideas and dogma and rituals and beliefs that served us when we were at lower levels of awareness, but now need to be reevaluated. We need to reconsider them. We have to decide, let me look at them again. Let me review them. Let me reinterpret them and see if they're still valuable to me as I'm climbing and reaching different altitudes in awareness. We get taught things when we're children, and because a children has a limited ability to understand complex ideas that would be necessarily have to be explained in complicated and sophisticated language, we're not going to be able to understand that. And because we're a child and with limited awareness of language skills and so on, that the explanations tend to be very rudimentary and with very few nuances. But as we get older, as we climb, we need to let go of many of these basic beliefs that were handed to us. You know, right? We think of Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and the fairy godmothers and some of these other things that were presented to us to try to help us to make sense of what we were experiencing and to buy into it. But after a while, we recognize we're willing to let go of some of those things. We can process more elevated ideas, and frankly, as we grow, as we ascend the mountain, we want to let go of infantile ideas. We can release them so that we make room, mind share, for thinking and feeling higher concepts so we can embrace them. This idea is so obvious, but it is overlooked by a lot of people because they refuse to upgrade their thinking. They learn something in Sunday school at 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 years old and are unwilling to budge off of that. And that sounds to me as if they had been fed pureed food as an infant because that's all they could handle. That's all they could digest physically or mentally. And years later, they refuse to move on to solid food because it's very convenient. There's no challenge. They don't have to worry about that. Even though solid foods, higher ideas, more complicated, sophisticated thinking would serve them better as they live their life. It would make them more effective. They would be able to navigate and climb more easily and more enjoyably. But because they're in fear of changing, that they hold on, they dispute the value of adding solid food or new ideas to their diet. And so no matter how many times they're told how much it would be beneficial to them, they resist it out of fear. Carrying ineffective beliefs that weigh us down, that mislead us in our climb, or even trip us up, is a really common problem. And you can see that when arguments start politically or about religion or other areas, you can just see non-sophisticated reasoning then triggers. Holding on to these old ideas that don't serve us, kind of like a pack rat who is afraid to throw away things because of fear. Someday, I'm going to need this. I'm going to have to justify my life and that fear tricks people into holding on to unworkable, infantile, not true ideas of God, life, risk, possibility, opportunity, etc. I've talked about demands in other talks, both the positives and the negatives of demands. Today I want to reemphasize that demands are essential to our lives because demands call energy to us from outside and from within us, from our spiritual center. Frankly, I think we create these demands ourselves as compared to them being put on us by other people. I think mostly we create these challenges so we can grow and reach toward the divine on our own, that being the purpose of our lives, as far as I'm concerned. And without demands, like most of us would say, oh, you know, boy, I sure would like an easy life. I sure would like an easy life. I doubt it. I doubt it. You know, if we laid on the couch and ate bonbons for about a week, we would, like, after that be like, this is driving me crazy. I need a challenge. I need a problem. I need struggle. I need a different game to play. Because without demands, we usually don't reach in either direction. We don't reach outside for additional resources and help, and we don't reach inward to find out what we're made of. And if you look at demands from a growth standpoint, it seems pretty easy to me to recognize that the roots of plants, for instance, reach deeper into the soil. They grow deeper into the soil looking for nutrition. And the demands for light causes the leaves and the stalks of trees and branches and flowers and plants to orient toward the sun, to be able to collect sun. This phototropic nature of most green plants is just like us. Just like us. We turn to the source of light, except in our case, I'm spelling light with a capital L versus a lowercase l, as in the sun, S-U-N. Since individuality is the essence of the life that we experience, individuality. We need to understand that concept in an effort to remove some of the confusion about being an individual. It occurs to me that individuality is a function of space and separation. If there wasn't space around you and an object near you, I happen to be sitting on a chair looking at a computer, looking at a scene out of a resort window. If there was no separation, there's no space between me and any one of these other things, I wouldn't be able to be an individual. The same is true. If you weren't separate from the person around you, you wouldn't be an individual. And that's what occurs at birth. We separate from the person that we were combined with, and then we become an individual. And you go, I get it. It's essential to us to do that. And so, consider this. Life is a dilemma of trying to individuate and trying to combine. The control of that process of separating and combining is what's confusing and challenging for most people. When we want to combine with what we perceive that will help bolster us, will strengthen us, will expand us, then we're going to go for that. We're going to want to combine with that. We also will try to separate from those things that will make us less, according to our perceptions, those things that are going to diminish us. We're going to try to avoid those. We're going to separate, put more distance between us and them. Now, we do that. We do that. So this process of combining and separating can be seen from the earliest days of our physical life. You can see it in an infant. You see an infant who is now fed at the mother's breast push itself away, push the mother, push itself away. It's trying now to separate after it had combined to the mother's nipple in order to be nourished, in order to get energy. We even use words like the terrible twos and terrible threes to show our confusion about this process of a child practicing, trying to establish the limits of their separation. When we say to a child, do such and such, that is, combine with such and such activity, and the child goes, no, I don't want to. And we tell the child to not combine with something, leave that alone, and they go, no, they want to touch things, they want to experience things, they want to do that. All that childhood is really about trying to learn about what to combine with, what to separate from. And if we don't understand that natural set of actions, we're going to be confused by other people, not only children, but adults' behavior, that they're combining sometimes and separating time at other times when we don't want them to. And the same is true for ourselves. We can find ourselves when we're separating from something that we want to combine with, or combining with something when we want to separate from. And you just go, I'm getting it, I'm getting it. And you probably had these conversations in your own head if you didn't speak them aloud. When you see something, some behavior in another person, you go, what are they doing? Why are they doing that? Or if you're trying to get yourself to do something or not do something, but you can't control that process, you say, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Even procrastination is an indication of this process of separation at work. Just think of it. Part of us says, I need to combine with this particular activity, this effort, this project, this job, but another part of them is going, we need to separate from this. So we're in this battle, do I combine with this and do the job? Do I separate from it and put more space between me and it? Should I do it? Should I not? Should I do it? Should I? And if we are separating more than we're combining, we use the word procrastination. Oh, I'm procrastinating. Yeah. So the difference, of course, would be to, why am I separating from this thing? What painful thing is being processed by me that's causing me to want to separate from this activity when another part of me is looking for the reward of accomplishing it? As children and other immature beings, like you and me, and teenagers and every other adult, display the grab-and-go behaviors driven by the ego. And those grab-and-go tendencies, you know, take what we want and get out of there, or push away what we don't want with a zero consideration for other people. That's when we have conflicts arising in our relationships because of those behaviors. I'm starting to think now that parenting young children is primarily concerned with the development of understanding of what we want or we think the child should combine with and what we think the child should separate from. How about these words? Here, eat your vegetables. We want the child to combine with that vegetables because it'll make them healthy, it's good for them, nutrition and all of that. And we say, don't play with matches. Don't stay away from those kids next door. And then we want them to combine with good habits. Do your homework. Take out the garbage. And you just go, combining, separating. If the child can make effective choices about which to do, their lives are going to be different than the person who can't distinguish which to combine with, which to separate from. Consider addictions as confusion related to those ideas. Immature people, all of us, let our emotions dictate what we're going to combine with and what we're going to separate from. Whereas more mature people make what I call a contextual decision. They look at what possibilities exist in terms of combining, separating, what their goals are, what they want to accomplish, and then they make a decision as to what is valuable to advance them toward that goal. And then they choose what to combine with and what to separate from based upon that context. It seems obvious that we want to get closer to what we want and we want to get further away from what we don't want. That's the nature of human life and it's the nature of human consciousness. We're all that way. And so you are, I am. Our parents, our grandparents were, our siblings were, all of our ancestors were, other relatives are, our spouses, our ex-spouses, our children, our grandchildren, everybody is this way. We want to get closer to what we want, and we want to get further away from what we don't want. So if everybody is in the same in this regard of wanting what we want and not wanting what we don't want, why are there such vast differences, and what explains it, those differences in human behavior? I'd say the different expressions of human behavior is based upon the different levels of human consciousness. It's pretty simple, really. Let me give you a few over-the-top, exaggerated examples to drive this point home. If you and I were walking and we encountered a primitive caveman, and there on the ground between us and that caveman was something that he wanted and we wanted, it is safe to assume that that caveman would not ask us to sit down at a negotiating table to work out a win-win solution to see who gets a chance to combine with that object of our attention. If we didn't like the looks of that caveman and he didn't like our looks, we can imagine that how he expressed his dislike for our looks was going to be much more intense than the way we would express our dislike for his looks. If we walked into a bank that was being robbed, we would be able to recognize that this was not the same as the process of applying for a loan. In each of these cases, and they're exaggerated, obviously, there's a huge difference in the way that other human beings are viewing situations. Take a normal today kind of a view that you and I usually have, but because we have caveman potential and have exhibited it many times in life, I'm certain, today, and as normal people, we would have thoughts of fairness, honesty, legality, morality, kindness, respect, the value of communication, the value of work, etc. However, a more primitive, lower awareness person would more than likely have much simpler, more binary, this, that kind of point of view. You have it, I want it. I want it, I take it. You're different, you're bad. You're different, I hurt you. You have energy, I take it. I dominate you, you don't dominate me. And on and on and on. Now you would go, wow, this is the year 2011. And you can read in the newspaper all day long, every day, if you could have the stomach for it, this kind of behavior being exhibited by very, very powerful, influential people. And you go, whoa, caveman, wearing a blue suit and a white shirt and a tie does not make you something other than the caveman. It makes you a caveman in a blue suit, white shirt, and a tie if your consciousness is at this low level. I have news for all of us. We have been both that primitive caveman, cavewoman many times in this life, and we're going to be it many more times. The goal, of course, that all of us have is to reduce those number of occurrences. And we've also been, and this is encouraging, the higher vibration, the higher awareness person many times in this lifetime. So we're looking to tilt the scale in the direction of higher consciousness, higher awareness behaviors, thoughts, and feelings away from that lower level. The difference in any situation, if you faced it today or tomorrow or the next day, is that the energy field that we happen to activate when we happen to be in any kind of energy exchange experience with a thing or a person or an idea. As we process those environmental signals, you should be able to feel your energy shift into a defensive mode or an open mode. Bruce Lipton would call one self-protect mode and the other, the open one, the growth mode. And there's a huge difference over time in a person's success and health and well-being. I would say that the goal in the game of life that you and I and many others are playing is the game to raise our consciousness by reaching out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness and asking for enlightenment. That's why we pray, to let go of this old stuff so we can jettison these old ideas that hold us back, that weigh us down, that trip us up. That's what we want to do. We may not use exactly those same words, but if we're trying to improve the amount of love that we can deliver and to receive to our families and other people important to us, and maybe to the environment and the world, that's what we're doing. Other people, though, and sometimes us, we're playing a game with a different purpose, and that is the purpose of getting the most money, the most power, the most influence, the most control, without regard for the other person or the planet or anything else. Now, the tools of those people are not going to necessarily be the club that we proverbial think is the tool of a caveman, this club that hits stuff over the head and drags it into his cave. But instead, they're going to be more sophisticated. Those weapons are going to be deceit, lie, corruption, war, prisons, and myriad form of human brutality goes on all the time. Again, refer to the 6 o'clock news if you've got any doubts about that. In every situation we experience, including those that we have already experienced at the hands or words of cavemen, cavewomen, parents and teachers and abusers and so on, we can and need to respond to them energetically in some form. If we're still holding on to that energy, we've got to deal with it in an effective way. We can work to develop an awareness regarding those experiences, and we can reinterpret them. We can review them and choose a different meaning. We can give them different meanings. And our responses now, and this is the ultimate goal, would be to respond with love and compassion versus anger or resistance, which is clearly much more toward the caveman end of the spectrum. And if we are able to respond with higher vibration, with compassion, acceptance, self-acceptance, and love, and to be able to see deeper into the experiences and the behaviors of other people and ourselves, we're going to be helping ourselves and others in a couple of four different ways or so. Number one, we're going to make healing possible for ourselves by letting go of resistance and rejection. Resistance and rejection puts a force field around us that prevents our good from coming to us. It limits what we can have in terms of health, happiness, goodness, love. Two, when we do this, we're sowing seeds for future harvest of love and compassion that will necessarily, according to the law of cause and effect, come to us. So we will have harvests that are coming to us of love and compassion in this lifetime, in whatever time frame necessary, in future lifetimes. This is really what we're looking to do. We will reap what we sow. What is very helpful too, and this is the third point of how this is valuable, is we're going to model for other people other ways to be, other ways to do, other ways to have. And our modeling can give them an image that up to this point they haven't had about ways a person can live a life, then all of a sudden we activate this spark of good within them, and now all of a sudden their consciousness is awakened, and now the top of the mountain that they are perceiving is different than the one that they perceived before we modeled something of a higher nature to them. We owe that to them and to the world, because if all of us are trying to elevate our consciousness, the entire world is better off. And the fourth thing is, I say that we're elevating our consciousness, our location on the mountain of consciousness. And that's the reason we came into physical form in the first place, to learn how to do. So as we ascend and make progress toward the top of the mountain, it's like, oh, that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. And the more I can enjoy it, the more I can help other people up the same mountain. I'm not climbing this solo. It doesn't happen. Nobody climbs a mountain solo. And even if the mountain is virtual, like a mountain of consciousness, we don't do it solo. In other words, we started at the beginning so that we could travel to the top level of Christ's consciousness. That's the top of the mountain. And if we're moving in that direction, we feel good about it, and that's all we have to do, is we have to keep on doing that and bring as many people as we can along with us. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer in letter 8 of Christ Returns Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care, and that's the way to climb the mountain of consciousness. Thank you. It is so. Amen.